From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 14th day of March 2023. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office for the week. So no update to the commodity markets. However, we will hear an excerpt from the farm policy discussion that took place last Tuesday at the All Day Ag Outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. All of those presentations, by the way, up online right now at willag.org. Today, we'll hear from Nick Paulson and Ag Policy Specialist Jonathan Kappas about the Inflation Reduction Act, conservation, and the 2023 Farm Bill debate. Jonathan Kappas opened the session.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
I still say the biggest question mark or the biggest thing we're waiting to see work out is the debt ceiling question. And until we figure out where things are going and lifting the debt ceiling, which we technically reached in January, it's going to be hard to see Congress move forward any kind of legislation with mandatory spending like we see in a farm bill. So I think, you know, if you've got great insights on where the debt ceiling debate ends up, that'll kind of tell us a lot about kind of what sets the stage for a farm bill debate. But between now and then, I think we're going to see a lot of this process work. Maybe the committees start some of the initial drafting pieces, but a big chunk of that's going to be determined by whatever deals are reached around the debt ceiling.
Can you give us a quick and short history lesson about the Farm Bill and maybe transitions over the last 30 years? So the 1981, I think, bill, the 85 bill, 80 bill, 85 bill, 91, and 96 bills in particular, and how that works into what's happening today.
We got 3 hours, right?
plug your book if you want the long history.
Yeah,
there's a fantastic book out.
It's only been 90 years. I think the biggest thing you look at is in recent times, the 1985 Act, which solidified the conservation programs that we now see, which you talked about, the Inflation Reduction Act, which added funding into some of those conservation programs. So the 85 Act is key. The 1996 Farm Bill, the Federal Agriculture Improvement Reform or Freedom to Farm, which decoupled the Title I program payments from your planting decision, started off with a 7-year AMPTA, if you remember the 4-letter word of AMPTA, payments that became direct payments in 2002. And then the next big shift, and this is maybe what you're kind of teeing up a little bit, the next big shift in farm policy then would have been the 2014 Farm Bill, which was preceded by a big fight over the debt ceiling in 2011. And coming out of that discussion in 2011 was a sort of across-the-board mechanism to cut spending and a real push to cut spending. And the major change in the 2014 Farm Bill was elimination of direct payments. So up in from 96 to 2014, you were getting those annual direct payments in some form or fashion, roughly $5 billion a year. And when sort of everything got consumed by the debt ceiling debate and discussion and debacle in 2011, one of the things that got eliminated in that process when Congress finally got a farm bill written were the direct payments. So again, kind of an indicator that these budget discussions, while much bigger than a farm bill, have real driving implications into how those programs get negotiated and revised.
Did total amount of dollars flowing into the farm community drop with that? I mean, was the projection that they dropped, not that they actually dropped, that was the projection that it was going to drop?
Right. And that's always sort of the challenge with the Congressional Budget Office efforts is it's not reality. I mean, it's a projection of the future. And when they score it against those projections. And so in 2014, the estimate was that we were going to cut about $23 billion out of the programs over a 10-year score. So roughly $2.3 billion a year. Initially, we spent more than they expected, and then it tailed off. So there were more savings if you held static just what they were thinking the scoring and spending would be in 2011. It actually ended up saving more money over time. The SNAP program participation came down. The farm programs didn't spend out as much as they had initially estimated. So, but The problem is you don't get any credit for that, right? That when they started writing the 2018 Farm Bill, there were members arguing like, oh, we should get credit for having saved funding. And in a sense, yeah, the programs did, but you also don't get charged when they spend more than was originally expected as well. So it's kind of a hold steady budget analysis that isn't completely connected to what is going on, which makes it difficult sometimes to understand.
So this year looks a little bit like that 20.
Well, for all of our sanity's sake, let's hope not. I mean, 2011's budget fight kicked off a 3-year two Congress farm bill debate. You know, the Senate passed it twice. The House defeated it once, split it apart, brought it back together. We had a government shutdown in September of 2013. I mean, it was a series of challenges for that farm bill debate. So hopefully we're not recycling a lot of that. But
yeah, that was supposed to be the 12 farm bill.
Yeah.
I remember because I gave presentations on it for 3 years. Supposed to be the 12 farm bill and then the 13 farm bill and then the 14 farm bill. Yeah. I have a little bit different perspective on the evolution over that time frame. I guess Jonathan's experience with, you know, the budget side of things, but I also see sort of the trend in particularly the commodities handle, the shift, even going back to 08, really getting away from direct payments, which easy to budget, easy to, you know, easy for you, easy for your lender to know what to expect moving forward, to programs that are contingent, more risk-based programs. So roll out of ACRE with sort of the trade-off with direct payments in the 08 bill, and then the kind of the bigger shift in 14 to ARC PLC, and then really just kind of the tweaks that we've seen since then. And, you know, the CBO baseline thing is complicated. Again, they're projecting what the programs we currently have, the way that they're defined, what they would cost over the next 10-year period is what CBO does. And so any tweak that any group wants to make, whether it's, you know, corn growers speaking with congressional staff on your behalf or the Soybean Association or other groups, you know, they always are tweaks that are going to end up probably making the program more expensive because it's an improvement. And that's usually the result of improvements we'd like to see. And the challenge with the scoring game is that that means that that additional cost would have to come out of another program, which someone else is advocating for tweaking that would make it more expensive too. So it's a, again, Jonathan knows more about kind of the on the ground way that process works, but it's challenging.
What made the direct payments, and I'm working towards what might be the low-hanging fruit this time around under the debt ceiling, but what made the direct payments the easy target?
Oh, they were – so you got to transport back a little ways. So we were just coming out of the 08 recession, Great Recession, and so you had a spike in all the counter-cyclical programs like unemployment insurance, like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And, you know, we had a struggling economy. At the same time, the farm economy was doing quite well. And I don't remember all the numbers, but I do recall conversations about record incomes, particularly when the you were post second round of the renewable fuel standard right before the big drought in 2012. But at the time, it's sort of the oddities of these budget discussions. So it's $5 billion a year. It's not a huge cost in a multi-trillion-dollar federal budget, but it was a very clear point that people could make. And look, we're paying farmers $5 billion every year, and they've got record incomes, record economic situation, and the rest of the economy had tanked. And so there was this sort of, you know, you were outside of that, right? It made it very difficult to defend $5 billion a year while everybody wanted to cut something and cut as much as they could in a down economy. So I think that was kind of that outlier position that direct payments found themselves in. And to Nick's point, I mean, they were simple. You could understand what they were. You weren't talking about changing reference prices or ARC calculations or any of those complications. It was, they get $5 billion every year.
What's the low-hanging fruit this time around? And maybe we ought to talk about what's actually farm bill and what's not, like crop insurance, not quite farm bill, but ARC PLC, and conservation are.
Yeah, and I think you were going to go into the ARC PLC a little bit. I mean, the expectations for those programs are they're not going to spend anything the next couple of years. So they're not an easy, I mean, we're looking over 10 years, so there is funding, and the PLC is the largest expected or projected item of spending in Title I. So that's always a possibility, but you're not going to see much in the near term. And look, crop insurance is pushing $100 billion over 10. It's like 97, I think, now in the CBO projection. So that's going to have a huge focus. If we're going to cut spending and we're going to fight about cutting spending, I would expect people to look at premium subsidy, which is somewhere between the $6 and $8 billion a year range, is possibly one of those things that gets thrown into the mix. That's, you know, again, this is the unfortunate reality, and we see it particularly around the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. When everything is, you know, the old adage, when all you have is a hammer, everything's a nail. Well, when all you are talking about is budget, then all you're doing is hitting, you're looking for big numbers, right? You're not looking for any nuanced policy discussion. You're not looking for any, what are the outcomes and consequences? It is, here's a big number, take it out on that. So SNAP is always a target because of that. And, you know, oftentimes missing that it serves 40 some million people who are buying food with that money. Crop insurance becomes a bigger target because it is the standout now, particularly as compared to Title I programs. And that's going to be challenging.
So, well, and the other challenge that introduces for, I guess, us in the Midwest is our crops are the big price tag crops too. So any little improvement, any little change that gets proposed for corn or beans or to a lesser extent wheat, a lot harder to make that work. Whereas our southern friends, the price tag on, you know, adjustments to reference prices for rice are much different. Rice or peanuts are much different than what it looks like if you're trying to get something in for corn or soybeans.
And for the record, I didn't start that and I didn't open it.
I started it for a reason, Jonathan. You're sitting next to
me. I know.
Hoping to coat you a little bit.
Yeah. It's one of the sort of oddities of an over budget focused policy debate. Little crops like peanuts, you can spend $150 an acre and it doesn't score anything compared to 95 million acres of corn. It's going to cost a lot of money in a baseline.
So am I right in coming to this conclusion, at least at the moment, that while we're talking about the 2023 Farm Bill and likely to frame it that way, that the debt ceiling discussion probably would revolve around the food and feeding programs within the Farm Bill, but not likely the farm programs in the Farm Bill, but rather the crop insurance program, which is not.
I mean,
does the debt ceiling debate, is that one way? I know it's probably one way that it works out, but is that the way it likely works out?
So the problem with this debt ceiling discussion that we're having right now is we've taken off the table some of the largest items in the federal budget, and we have yet to see any proposal as to what spending cuts people want to see and how they want to go about making those spending cuts. So right now it's kind of a very gray, uncertain area of like, well, we want to cut spending. And from everything I've ever witnessed in these discussions, it's easy to say you want to cut spending. It's a whole lot harder to say, yeah, but I want to cut that spending. I mean, just look in the Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare discussion. The moment you start talking about cutting one of those programs, and those are large items in the federal budget, you know, the politics get extraordinarily difficult. Look at the defense budget, $700, $800 billion a year. You start talking about cutting that kind of set of programs, it gets very difficult very quickly. So in the same space with the Farm Bill, we can cut spending, but it becomes, well, cut SNAP. Well, that's not going to fly. So you're going to have people looking for other cuts. That's when crop insurance, conservation, Title I get pulled into the discussion. So it's unlikely that if we are in a budget cutting, spending reduction discussion, that anything comes out without something being taken from it.
Talk about the Inflation Reduction Act, how it works within this debt ceiling and what that might mean to the conservation programs, which were funded. You probably should start there. in the IRA. And if you've got a question, now's the time to start thinking about it and holding your hand up.
Yeah. And, you know, Nick and I were talking about this before. And so, I mean, just since we're stuck in CBO land at the moment, there's both goods and bads. So the Inflation Reduction Act added roughly $18 billion in a multi-year appropriation to a subset of conservation programs for a subset of practices, mostly built around nutrient loss reduction, soil health, and climate change resiliency or mitigation. So storing carbon dioxide equivalent in the soil sort of thing. So you think of cover crops, right? This is kind of the first one we think about. So that $18 billion was put into existing programs with existing baseline, but it's not baseline spending. So there's actually not a long-term impact. They'd have to resend that spending and use it to offset spending elsewhere to do something with it, which gets complicated in a hurry. So it's kind of one of those oddities that it's like, oh, we've got a pot of $18 billion sitting here. And you can imagine that if you put a pot of $18 billion, people will spend it four times over in 18 different ways. And so it's going to complicate, I think, some of these discussions there as to how to use it, but it doesn't factor into the way CBO estimates these things over time. So the committees do not have an easy extra set of funding. It actually probably politically turns into a lot more of a problematic scenario because of the way it's designed.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I view it in the negative way to look at it is it's, you know, well, the IRA gave conservation this $18 billion over 10. So we can cut money out of conservation and the Farm Bill to help pay for other things or to go towards spending reductions. But the problem then is you're trading forever dollars in baseline for not forever dollars in the IRA. But with 2 and 4 year election cycles, forever is very fluid definition. So
it does change quickly. Who's got a question out here that they want to ask about? Yes, sir.
Yeah.
What's the possibility they'll extend the Farm Bill?
Yeah. I mean, if you're betting on it, the Farm Bill, this is where it gets a little odd too. The Farm Bill has expiration dates, and that is either the crop year 2023, the fiscal year 2023, which is September 30th of this year, or calendar year, if it's dairy, for example. So I would expect at least some extension, but the odds that Congress doesn't reauthorize things in kind of the full scope and basically pushes it out further are pretty good. I mean, you know, if you're betting on it, that's better than a 50-50 chance. I don't know if you got an odds.
I mean, we did the meeting back in November in Champaign. Mm-hmm. That was my favorite for the outcome was that we would just get an extension.
What other things do we need to be watching in farm policy? Anybody got one out here they want to ask?
Well, I know not to pick on Stu, but he had a good question about kind of what else is in sort of the discussion mix. And the other kind of oddity that we're trying to wrap our collective political brain around is in the last 5 years. So since the 2018 Farm Bill was reauthorized, we've been in this very unusual situation in which we've had the administration, successive administrations now, issuing payments on an ad hoc or supplemental basis. And so we have seen the market facilitation program twice, 18 and 19. Then we've seen the coronavirus food assistance program, CFAP, multiple. I think we're up to four waves of that at this point. And that has dwarfed any spending under Title I. I mean, if you compare Title I program spending, the ARC and PLC, to what's come out in supplemental programs, it's not even close. I mean, the 1 year we hit 40 some billion dollars in just ad hoc spending. So really massive outlays to farmers through some non-farm bill mechanism. That, you know, I don't know how that impacts the debate. That certainly sets your expectations in a lot different place. Nick started me to pick on rice. In the omnibus appropriations bill at the end of last year, there was a $250 million payment to rice. I don't know why. I mean, they claim that they've, you know, had troubles, that it's they've struggled with prices and costs. But if you look at the numbers, it's hard to see why rice needed $250 million. they cut their deal, right? And so there's an expectation that there's that this money is out there, and it's none of those additional funds, none of those ad hoc programs get any baseline. Like there's nothing there the committees can use. They can't cut anything. Like you can't cut a CFAP program and use that spending to do something else. And Stu raised a question, you know, does that kind of set up this this expectation that Congress will write a new ad hoc or disaster program? And, you know, I struggle with how to even think about adding a disaster program, because you've got two major problems. The first major problem is your scoring issue. So think about this. If you do a $2 billion a year disaster program, that's not a lot. I mean, it's a lot of money to any of us, but it's not a lot of money in the federal spending line. $2 billion is a $20 billion score in a CBO because they have to multiply everything by 10 years. So it is expensive very quickly. That more than takes up all the IRA money. So you have a huge cost there. And then the other side of it is we have a $97 million crop insurance program, which is extraordinarily effective and used by farmers. And we have roughly $4-5 billion a year in Title I payments. Where do you squeeze a new ad hoc program in? And if you go back to 2008 and the Supplemental Revenue Assistance, the SURE program, remember how complicated that mess was? Part of the complications, we were trying to fit it in there so you wouldn't double dip in crop insurance. You wouldn't double dip in Title I. So I don't see a lot of policy room, let alone budget room, to do ad hoc assistance. But, you know, people get creative
too. Yeah, and our colleague Joe Jansen has written more about ad hoc than either one of us have. But, you know, SURE is a great example. It's really hard to think about designing a disaster assistance program that is, you know, a one size fits all for all disasters. You know, we've got different commodities that have different needs. We have crops, we have livestock. And, you know, kind of I view the definition of disaster assistance as kind of being such that you can't have a good, well-designed standing program. It just doesn't work. Because when a disaster happens, it creates unique challenges, and you can't have the foresight to think about every situation that could be possibly rolled into it. And so, you know, disaster assistance in my mind sort of, if we're going to do it, it kind of has to be ad hoc if it's really going to be effective, because it has to be tailored to the situation at hand.
And I think also we throw into that the coronavirus assistance provided assistance to a much larger share of farmers than Title I typically does. So a lot of the fruit and vegetable, nut crops, a lot of livestock producers got direct payments through those programs that don't typically see anything out of Title I. So once you open the door, I imagine there's a lot of people in line for how that program would look.
Jonathan Kappas is an agricultural policy specialist, and Nick Paulson is an agricultural economist at the University of Illinois. They took the stage last week at the All Day Ag Outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. You can find more online at willag.org.